Good morning, church. A couple of weeks ago, Tom Martindale posted a meme on Facebook, and it went something like this. This morning I jogged 3.5 miles, and then I woke up. Tommy, that sounds a lot like my exercise program. You know, if you watch much TV, I'm sure you've seen those TV commercials for all the various exercise machines, the Peloton treadmills and the Nordic Trek stair steppers and ab rollers and thigh masters and Pilates balls and mini trampolines. But have you ever noticed that the folks using them in those commercials are always gorgeous, muscular young men and women who never seem to break a sweat? Never have a hair out of place, always have a big smile on their face. I don't know about you, but I don't look a thing like that when I'm exercising. Those commercials feed the faint hope that if you just buy this machine or this video or this book, then you too can look like that. Devote a few bucks and a minimal amount of effort and you too can have washboard abs and perfect glutes. And you can do it all in just a few minutes a week without the need for much exertion or sacrifice. In fact, that's a pervasive theme across American commercial life. You too can have the perfect body, the perfect home, the perfect life, painlessly and effortlessly if you'll just buy the right products. But of course, to cover their assets, they always include that disclaimer hidden in the fine print. Your results may vary. You know, I think a lot of people view their spiritual lives similarly. They're looking for quick and painless solutions to whatever spiritual rut they find themselves in. They want results, but without much effort. They imagine that they can get spiritually fit without breaking a sweat, spiritually lean without at all curbing any of their appetites. If they belong to a church at all, it's probably the church of the brunch, church of the matinee, church of happy hour. Now, I try never to criticize anyone else's spiritual path, but for me, it's hard to imagine growing physically stronger without some physical exertion. And I can't imagine growing spiritually stronger without some spiritual exercise. And it seems to me that that's a big part of what religion is, spiritual exercise. A recent Pew survey found that 28% of American adults are religiously non-affiliated. And that group has been growing every year. But here's something surprising about that statistic. About half of those folks still think of themselves as spiritual. You probably know some folks who consider themselves to be spiritual but not religious. Maybe some of you even consider yourself among that group. But why do you think that spiritual but not religious has become such a popular way for many Americans in particular to describe themselves? Well, here's a possible clue just from our own congregation. Many years ago, in preparation for a sermon series, our pastor emeritus, Reverend Ken Martin, asked the members and friends of this congregation to name those factors that had been significant barriers to belief in their lives. Did you guess the single factor that was named most frequently by members of this congregation as a barrier to belief? Well, I won't keep you in suspense. It was religion. That's right, religion was the factor that was cited most often as a barrier between folks in this congregation and God. And if you think about it, that's a pretty remarkable thing for the members and friends of any Christian church to say. Religion is the most significant barrier to belief in their life? Really? And if we were to take a similar survey today, I wonder, would the results be the same? Well, I wouldn't be surprised. Because on one hand, it's really not all that surprising, particularly in an MCC church. Many of us who are gay, lesbian, transsexual, or transgender, or bisexual have experienced religion used as a club to batter us into submission or into silence. Many of us were raised in churches where we weren't free to be our authentic selves. And if we tried, we were unceremoniously shown the door. Reverend Dr. Paul Dodd back there sent me an article just this past week entitled, "Religious Trauma Still Haunts Millions of LGBTQ Americans." Can any of you relate to that? Religion has been used to demean and diminish us and the most important relationships in our lives. Every day in the media, we see religious figures spreading the lie that God's love is highly selective. We see our most important religious text used as an excuse for intolerance. We see politicians claiming a deep and abiding faith and yet supporting the most ungodly and hurtful policies imaginable. We see religion used to justify hateful and divisive positions, to condemn and to exclude. Our government, particularly here in Texas, consistently threatens to take away our rights, often under the guise of bolstering the religious freedom of some other group, which really means giving them the freedom to discriminate against us. But of course, it's not just LGBTQ folks. Religion has come to be so widely identified with a message of condemnation and exclusion that a lot of folks, gay and straight, would rather just do without. Perhaps they've become convinced that those voices of condemnation and reproach are the authentic voice of God instead of the voice of some of God's misguided followers. Or maybe they begin to doubt the very existence of a God who would punish anyone simply for being their authentic selves. Religion and Middle East expert Charles Kimball has written a wonderful little book entitled "When Religion Becomes Evil." In this book, he lists what he sees as some of the warning signs of corruption in religion. There are things like making absolute truth claims, demanding blind obedience, using the ends to justify any means, and declaring holy war. Now, I'm sure that you can easily recognize those as characteristics of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups in the news, and they are. But if you read Kimball's descriptions of those corruptions, it's pretty easy to see many examples of them in the American religious landscape as well, and in the way religion expresses itself in American political dialogue. He writes, quote, "Whatever religious people may say about their love of God or the mandates of their religion, when their behavior toward others is violent and destructive, when it causes suffering among their neighbors, you can be sure that the religion has become corrupted and reform is desperately needed," unquote. And I'll note here that the violence and the destructive behavior he's talking about isn't just physical violence. It's also verbal, psychological, political, economic, social, and sexual violence, things we find shamefully often in American religious experience. The great Protestant theologian Karl Barth once wrote, "The main message of the Bible is that God hates religion." God hates religion. I'm pretty sure that what he meant was that God hates the legalism, hypocrisy, and the divisiveness that often masquerades in the guise of religion. and that those of us who cherish the authentic gospel of Jesus Christ have to distance ourselves from the excesses of toxic religion. And I'm sure that's a big part of why many people choose to call themselves spiritual rather than religious. But paradoxically, I also believe that quite a few of the folks who describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, at least the ones who really mean it, are some of the most genuinely religious people around. I'm thinking, for example, of the Reverend Bob Lively, a retired Presbyterian pastor, teacher, and counselor, who spent 4 decades in professional ministry. For several years, he wrote a column on spirituality for the Austin American Statesman. And in one of his last columns, he wrote, quote, "I don't think of myself as religious. I much prefer the description spiritual," unquote. Now remember, this is an ordained Christian minister who served churches, including Riverbend Church here in Austin, for more than 30 years. But he goes on to say, quote, "In my view, religion has sparked more wars, be they among nations or within families, than it's done any real good in the sense of healing a broken heart, putting an end to violence, or reconciling nations. In fact, most people use religion today as a clever way of avoiding God. For as long as we cling to the illusion of security granted by a subculture rife with rites, rituals, and dogma, we can avoid God's claim upon our souls," unquote. But it seems to me that what Reverend Lively really wants is genuine spirituality without the baggage of toxic religion. And I'm with him 100%. It's certainly what I'd like to see as well. But being fed up with toxic religion, does that mean that we have to distance ourselves from religion entirely? I don't think so. In fact, I think it's time we retire that false dichotomy between spirituality and religion. And instead, let's embrace what I like to call spirit-filled religion. Because to me, the problem with spiritual but not religious is that often it's neither. When we remove ourselves from religious community, we risk creating a religion unto ourselves. We risk creating a God in our own image. We risk losing touch with the need to feed the hungry, care for the sick, stand in solidarity with the prisoners. And we risk missing out on the experience of sharing, exploring, questioning, and enhancing the traditions that are part of our collective religious heritage. Sure, there's a lot that's wrong with religion, but there's a lot that's right with it as well. Just think about the good work that happens through this church. Would those disadvantaged kids at Dawson Elementary have nourishing lunches if this church didn't provide them? Would dozens of families have had a brighter Christmas this past year if it hadn't been for the deacon's Christmas tree? Would others have a joyous Easter if not for our Purple Bunny Project? How many folks might go hungry if not for our brown bag collections? Would there be a safe place in South Austin for transgender kids and their families together if not for the Chrysalis Center? Would there be that shower truck where unhoused adults can get clean and find a bit of dignity if not for your collective generosity? Sure, you might do some of that on your own. And if so, I applaud you for it. But would you do all of those things? And the myriad other worthwhile things that happen because of the collective action of this religious community? Of course not. None of us could. But spirit-filled religion does all of those things through the collective action of this community of faith every day of the year. To quote from author and consultant Dan Hotchkiss, quote, "Religion encourages us to consider the contrast between life as it is and life as it should be, and urges us to close the gap. Religion and religious insights provide the handhold that people need to criticize injustice, rise above self-interest, and take risks to achieve healing in a wounded world." Unquote. Religion at its best is just an exercise program for our spiritual lives. Religion at its best is just a diet for our unhealthy appetites for the things that will damage our spirits. Religion at its best is just an organized program for furthering God's will in the world around us. Spirit-filled religion is religion at its best. So did Jesus have anything to say about the difference between spiritual and religious? I think so. Let's consider today's reading from the 18th chapter of Luke's Gospel. Jesus told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Two men went to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, "God, I thank you that I'm not like those other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heavens and was beating his breast and saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other." So let's recap. A Pharisee and a tax collector walk into a temple. The Pharisee is standing by himself and praying, probably in his most dramatic voice, "God, I thank you I'm not like those other people, like that tax collector over there. I fast, I'm generous with my money. Aren't I special?" And we're to contrast that with a tax collector. He's not even looking up to heaven, but he's pounding his chest and saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." Now, it's pretty clear which one Jesus thinks has found the right formula for addressing God. And many modern Christians who read this story will take the Pharisee and the tax collector as exemplars of the religious versus the spiritual path. The Pharisee, they'll say, is preoccupied with the trappings of religion and succumbs to self-righteousness, where the tax collector finds instead the spiritual path of humility. But I'm here to tell you that's a pretty shallow reading of this story. The biblical scholar Bernard Brandon Scott tells us that Jesus' Jewish listeners in the first century would not have heard the story in that way at all. In fact, they wouldn't have heard this as being about prayer at all. Instead, they would have heard it as a different kind of challenge, a challenge to the temple rules about who was an insider and who was an outsider. Because although the Pharisee's prayer sounds arrogant to us, "God, I thank you that I'm not like those other people," it's a variant of a prayer that faithful Jewish men said every morning, a prayer many Orthodox Jewish men still offer today. And moreover, the Pharisees' practice of fasting and tithing went far beyond what Jewish law required. So far from being arrogant and self-righteous, Jesus' listeners would have seen this Pharisee as a model of faithful Judaism and deserving of his status as the ultimate temple insider. As for the tax collector, he does nothing out of character either. He asks for God's mercy, but does nothing to prove that he's made amends for the way he's cheated the taxpayers. And there's no evidence that he plans to give up his lucrative but despised profession. Sure, he recognizes he's a sinner, but does he intend to change his ways? To Jesus' listeners, his prayer is just further confirmation that he too deserves his status as the ultimate temple outsider. So the behavior of these two men would not in any way have shocked Jesus' audience. They'd have been nodding their heads in recognition. But it was Jesus' conclusion that would have left them reeling, feeling as if they were standing on quicksand. I tell you, this tax collector went down to his home justified rather than the Pharisee. Jesus' listeners would have been stunned. How can this be? If this sinner's humble prayer is more pleasing to God than the rigorous observance of this righteous man, where can we stand? How can we know who's an insider and who's an outsider? How can we judge? How can we criticize? Who should we fault? Ah, but you see, that's the whole point. It's not given to us to judge, to criticize, to fault. It's not given to us to set the boundaries that separate inside from outside, us from them. And if we take this story as a way of justifying ourselves, thank God I'm not like that self-righteous Pharisee. That would be ironic indeed. I can almost hear Jesus saying, okay, let's go over this one more time. But don't we often pray the prayer of the Pharisee? Don't we sometimes indulge ourselves in finding fault with others, congratulating ourselves for how progressive and inclusive we are? God, we thank you that we're not like those other churches, the misguided fundamentalists, the right-wing evangelicals, the homophobic hate mongers. Does our powerful experience of God's welcoming spirit in this church tempt us to think that we're better in God's eyes or more deserving of God's love? Does our pride blind us to our own need for spiritual exercise? I hope we never lose sight of the special beings we are, but not because we're unlike those people out there. As the tax collector prayed, we're all in need of God's mercy. Yes, we are special, but only because all of us are children of a gracious God. And if we'll only see the truth of that and live it out in our every action, then that will be spirit-filled religion indeed. So what is our challenge? Our challenge is to ensure that we in this church never succumb to the temptations of toxic religion. Our challenge is to ensure that the religion we practice in this church is always spirit-filled religion. And here's what I think that means. It means proclaiming relentlessly the authentic gospel of God's all-inclusive love. It means opening our doors and our hearts to everyone who needs that message of hope. It means devoting ourselves to advancing God's dominion in our world. It means taking seriously Jesus' command to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the sick, comfort the imprisoned. It means making our worship an authentic celebration of God's goodness. It means making our language about God an accurate reflection of our understanding of the God whose very essence is love. It means being thankful for the bounty of God's creation and being good stewards of the resources that God has granted us. It means speaking the truth fearlessly to those who would divide and oppress. It means healing the wounds of toxic religion in our own people and replacing that with a healthy spirituality. And it means making sure that our religion and our spirituality coincide. Because if we do those things, then anyone who comes through our door will be able to say, at Uprising Austin, they practice spirit-filled religion indeed. May it be so. Amen.